Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today in studio we have two special guests. Ted Becker is the owner and broker of RE/MAX Results in Moreno Valley. Having started the company in 1989, he's also been experienced at practicing law, being a general contractor, and operating different types of developments. Mike Novak Smith is one of the leading REO agents in the entire country. Mike's in the top 1% of all real estate agents nationwide, and is experienced in REO short sales, bankruptcies, asset management, and negotiating. Mike specializes in REOs in Riverside and works with Ted's brokerage. Ted and Mike, welcome back. We had just touched on the difficulty in getting a loan, but yet when we look at the sales volume, even though it's not been tremendous, it's been misleading. Okay, and so what we as investors experienced is there were large piles of money enter our market, especially in an area like a Moreno Valley, where you had that price target that was attractive and it got driven up. I remember a conversation I had. I was holding a boot camp. I called up an agent. This house hadn't gone pending for like 7 days, and it was really in the teeth of where there was a lot of activity. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm just curious why that hasn't been pending. She said it hadn't been pending because we have over 100 offers, most of which are more than the asking price. It's so much over the asking price that it's not a short sale anymore. It's a normal sale. And she said, it takes me that much time to respond to the offers. And she said, I said, what percentage of them are cash? She said, 99% of them. Mm. And just like, oh my gosh. Okay. So the hedge fund in Moreno Valley, what impact do you think they had while they were really being active?
Well, I really don't know, because I don't know how many they were buying,
you know,
but I think that the investor market did push the price beyond itself, beyond what they were willing to pay. And so now we're sitting sort of flat,
but they geared themselves. You know, that was interesting, interesting thing that I was studying this last report that I wrote, that the target property had all of the impetus as far as, like that 1,200 square foot house in Moreno Valley that I had bought at 60, it's now worth 225, and they left alone the 3,500 square foot house 20 miles away that you could still buy at 225.
Right.
And so that investor pushed that. Now, what's interesting about what you said, and let me just mention this, is that I don't know that it mattered what percentage they bought. It mattered what percentage they offered on, and it was almost everything that moved.
Well, that's probably true. Yes.
They forced anybody that won to compete with what they were trying to do.
Right.
And so even if they bought 5% or 10% of it, they pushed 100% of the buyers to the next level of price.
Well, that I'm sure that's accurate. I agree.
Okay.
Yeah, many REOs, when you list them, even now, I would say, and I send them to Ted a lot of times, just we like to look at them, within 10 minutes you're getting 5 emails saying, we want to be your best friend. We want to buy these houses. I even get them from TV shows, you know, like where they flip houses, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they all want to be your friend, you know.
Like,
give us a deal. What can we do for you?
You told me it's not your lot in life to give investor deals.
Yeah, I'm not a provider of good deals.
Well, shoot. We thought you were. Is it... From a broker's side perspective, is it valuable to have a repetitive investor clientele? Somebody that's going to be there and do something they tell you they're going to do over
Absolutely.
And over again?
Absolutely. Sure.
Okay.
Sure. We love you.
Just like repeat REO sellers. I mean, I had one guy in 2004 and 2005 I sold 85 houses for. He bought them all at the trustee sale. It was a good time. He made money and so did I. It was fun.
Yeah.
If anybody buys multiple properties, is you know, it's good. It's easier.
Yeah. Well, you also know what to expect. That's like having, I mean, I have the same guy for painting I've had for 25 years because I know what to expect. And that's part of business. You want to simplify it. You just go, okay, I'm just going to call him and be done. So I guess there is some concern. This big hedge fund buyer came into our world for the first time and became a market maker in a way in price. Now they own a lot of rentals, and in a way they became market makers for rental.
Right.
Rental values.
Right.
Do you see any indication that some of them are breaking ranks and saying, let's sell the stuff?
I haven't seen it. I don't think it's their time yet. I think they've rented them out, and they've, you know, big thing you see in the REO business now is REO to rent. And there's a lot of buyers out there where they've purchased a lot of REOs and they rent them out, and they have thousands of them nationally. So I don't think they're ready to sell them.
I think it's still early, but there is I'm not going to be able to remember the name, but basically a group that is selling the idea of gathering up properties that are rented, that are investor-owned rentals, and selling them rented, selling them full, not emptying them before you sell them.
Okay.
Somebody came up with that idea and thought that's a great idea, and certainly that's a possibility. I think it's difficult to put 10 or 12 or 20 properties together. I don't know how you'd do that unless you were a hedge fund that owned all of them and you could sell 20 of them or 50 of them. But, you know, it's not like an apartment building. It's like 20 different rentals. But even that idea's been floated and webcasts have been done on it.
A lot of the people that were in California haven't disappeared. They just shifted locations. So they might have gone to Houston or they've gone to Florida. So they're still gathering, you know, inventory. They just changed hats and said, I'm, you know, going to go to someplace else.
I wonder about how many people are moving into California. You know, is there an impetus or an influx of people who will even want these homes?
It's an interesting problem because California really needs construction for migration. Mm-hmm. And at this point, you don't have a margin like in the Inland Empire. You have construction. It always depends on what charts you want to look at. Is it up from 2013? Yes. And it's down from 80% from a normal year at
right.
the same time.
Right.
So we're still not creating enough jobs to say, oh, gosh, you know, I'm gonna move. One of the things that was true is that there's a lot of talented people in construction that had nothing to do for years that roamed around the country and found oil jobs.
Right. Right.
And now oil was about down in half. And so I'm not sure, you know, how many people got laid off, but you can imagine quite a few. So what do you guys think of the economy in general? Because I know that's a big part of, you know, how California is going to do as well. It's just the general feel of the economy.
So, it seems to me the further inland you go, you get to the coast, it's a lot better. Sure. Further out you go, it gets harder to sell homes the further out you go. And I see a lot of that. I just closed one in Rancho Cucamonga, and it was a different animal than doing something in Hemet.
Oh, absolutely.
The quality of buyers was better. The activity was better. The prices, of course, were a lot more.
It's the traditional problem that the newspaper speaks in great regional words, and our little region is different from the Orange County, L.A. region. So the people who read the paper read a different news than what's really happening locally.
Right.
I don't think we see the increase. I think there are still layoffs going on in the Inland Empire, whereas other areas, the more higher-end areas, are probably hiring.
Yeah, they definitely have that phenomenon of, like, you just don't exist anymore. So you, mm-hmm. the unemployment rate goes down, but then you find out most of it's on the backs of people who just haven't tried for a year.
Sure.
And that's, sure. It seems like if you want to play with those statistics, you can make it say pretty close to anything
you
want.
Sure.
It doesn't feel healthier. I mean, I guess that's the sense. And I don't know. Sometimes you have personal experience. You walk into a store. I was in line, like I was, I don't know, 12th in line at a drugstore. And I wasn't complaining to the only person that was in existence behind the counter. But when I got there, I said, it's just a little unusual. It's the longest wait I've ever had. He said, well, everybody got their hours cut from 40 to 30.
Mm-hmm.
And,
or 29.
Yeah. Or 29, right. Whatever the magic marker was. And I said, oh, okay. So you have the same amount of people. But he said, not one of them full time. I said, wow, okay.
Very believable.
Yeah, so you got 25% less hours. All of mm-hmm. a sudden, you're trying to figure out how to make everybody happy as a customer. But you're not going to qualify for anything. right? I mean, you don't
correct.
You don't have a full-time job. You have a job, but you don't have a full-time job, and you may not have a really good paying one either.
I don't see, you know, when you read the car dealers, and the other offers, advertised zero financing, special deals, money back, $2,000 cash back when you buy this car, that doesn't tell me that things are good. That tells me that things aren't happening. And I don't think it's happening anywhere, really.
Well, it's interesting that that industry has been able to be aggressive while our industry has got handcuffs on. So maybe the way to make money is just a short automobile paper. I'm sure there's somebody who'll figure out how to do that.
Well, the car companies, what they've done is expanded their customer base, and they've expanded it by extending the loan periods, by lowering the credit standards. And, you know, they can make their own decisions. If they want to loan, take a chance on some borrower, they can. Worst scenario is they come back and get the car in a few months. Do that on a house, it's pretty ugly.
Yeah. That industry is basically has portfolio paper, or don't they sell the paper?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well,
it seems like
they probably sell the paper.
Yeah, I would think so. All right. No matter, I wonder where that paper goes. Wall Street putting bonds together for that?
Another good question. I've got another good question.
All right, I'm ready.
Well, when Freddie and Fannie fail and their loans go bad, and as I said before, those loans, the 5,400 loans that were bought by a hedge fund of some kind, whose money is that at this point? I mean, that loan's been originated and then sold and then sold and then securitized, and then somebody owns it, right? So somebody's losing money on that loan. Or is it being guaranteed by
the
taxpayers?
Yeah, I would guess that would be
the It's being guaranteed by the taxpayer.
Yeah, I think so.
And so really, whoever made that loan in the beginning, somewhere down the line, I mean, I know it's not portfolio, but it's still a loan. Somebody got money, and somewhere down the line, it's just all washed out, and the taxpayer covers it.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me.
And I guess the counter is that the Fannie Freddie has actually been pretty profitable since it's been in the government hands after going through all those losses.
Well, and the government's sweeping all that money into its own treasury.
Of course,
treasury.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not going where it's supposed to.
It's not going back to support the company, recapitalize.
No, but what's I guess what's interesting is we were invited back in about 2009 to speak with Fannie and FHA. And I left there with the distinct opinion that everyone in that room, whether it was Fannie Mae, thought they would not have a job in 10 years. And I didn't expect that. Mm-hmm. They just thought they were going to be downsized to zero. Now, I don't believe that's going to happen because I don't see the replacement. That's the problem, is that if there's still a big percentage of what happens, right? I mean, FHA is doing less and less loans. And so Fannie Freddie, if that disappeared, you have to ramp up for its replacement, right? That's not a small task.
True, but don't you think the conventional marketplace would ramp up? Now, absent the restrictions of Dodd-Frank today, which prevent the conventional market from doing anything, basically. But without that, I think the conventional market would step in and take over and make those loans.
Who would portfolio that size of money? In other words, you don't have a sell. You'd have to have an open market sale somewhere. I think your interest rates would change, and I think your term would change. I don't think you're going to write 30-year fixed loans then.
No.
Which other countries, by the way, don't?
Don't.
Yeah, we wouldn't be alone if we made that change. But it would be, definitely be a change, and I don't know.
Well, it would be like Europe. You'd pay more. You'd pay a higher rate. You'd pay a shorter loan period. But then you'd own a house
quicker
in a rational fashion.
I think that's the downside that is bad to me, is that you've got a 19 and a 21-year-old who want to go from renter to owner, and it's being prevented. And there's ramifications for that because 10 years down the road, if they're still a renter, they don't have equity. They don't have an equity line. Mm-hmm. They can't be an entrepreneur. They can't look at that payment and go, wow, we used to be afraid of that. Now it's nothing. Right. We're going to keep this as a rental and buy another one. You know, we're really cutting off a lot of future benefits by saying don't get into this now. And if that's not a rational decision, that's really sad.
It's a bad decision.
Yeah, it is.
Whether it's rational or not, it's a bad decision. or an unintended consequence that's bad.
Right. The seller that is selling a property right now, what are they doing? Are they staying in the area? Are they migrating out of California? They move up? What are they doing?
Most of the last few I've done that were owner-occupants, they're leaving the state. Job opportunities. I think a lot of it, you know, 10 years ago, I think people would wake up and say, I want to buy a new house today, like buying a pair of new shoes. It wasn't hard. It was easy, and they didn't put as much thought into it. Now it's much more difficult. You've got to sell your old house. You've got to have enough equity in it to buy the new one. You know, can they afford the upleg? It's tough.
I agree. I think there are virtually no elective sellers. There are always divorce, death, age. All those sellers still exist.
Right.
And they're the ones selling, I think, today.
Well, how many people have a loan mod where the house payment would have been $1,500 a month? Now they're paying $600 a month. Do you want to give that up? They used to give it up because I wanted to buy a new boat and have a place to park it. Well, you're really going to do that. And I think that's got to have a huge effect. I mean, 30% of the loan mods in California are currently failing. So, you know, it's just, but I do believe there's a lot of people that they've got such a good deal on their interest rate via a loan mod, or maybe they just have a good rate. They don't want to give it up. Maybe people are a little more conservative with their money, which may not be always a bad thing.
What about inventory levels and inventory mix? Are you feeling that they're at unhealthy levels or safe levels?
I think they're low.
They're low.
They're not unhealthy, I don't think.
No, I think
but
the
they're
mix.
Low. And the mix, hard to say.
But when you say they're low and yet the volume is low, so it's almost like that's a good combination, because if you had high sales and you had this inventory level, you'd have no inventory here pretty soon. Or you'd have people come out of the woodwork and say, I can finally sell.
I think the reason they're low is that the things aren't selling today, and the people who want to put their homes on the market today want more money for them than the things that are selling, so therefore they're putting it off. They're just,
okay.
Maybe I'll sell in May. Maybe I'll wait till June. That's what I'm hearing from people.
What is the typical reason for a loan turned down? So they think they're going to get it, and then they don't. So is there a repetitive reason there?
I think late discovered problems like child support liens and things like that are traditionally the biggest reason.
Most of the loans I see today, once they've actually got a pre-qual letter from a legitimate lender, I think the closing ratio is better than it used to be, because the quality of the guys and people out doing loans is better than it used to be. But many of them, I don't think, just make it through the pre-qual process. They're self-employed. You know, they've got no more easy loans, no more no-qual. So a lot of the self-employed crowd can't buy. And then, you know, a lot of them, their guidelines, like we discussed earlier, somebody doesn't have a job for 2 years, they can't buy. So I think a lot of that gets blown out of when you first start with the pre-qual process. Once you get to escrow, the fallout rate today is less than it used to be.
But I think something Mike said is important, and that is the initial pre-qualifying, how good quality is the lender that is representing the borrower? And that's really critical, because the most of the failures come from lenders that either we haven't dealt much with or are kind of low-end guys. The good, tested, well-tested lenders get the deals closed.
Plus, who wants to go through a dry run? I mean, that doesn't pay anybody.
Right.
Well, 10 years ago, a real common element to most real estate offices was they're doing loans too. Mm-hmm. We do loans. We do everything here. And most of that's gone. It is much more restrictive. So a lot of the old loan officers that were around then are still around, and they generally get it done. But they will quickly blow the deal out up front and let you know. I mean, I get a lot more of that. I go through a lot of people to ever get anybody that's qualified.
Of the first-time buyers, what percentage are typically single-person households?
Boy, I would say very few.
Really?
I think.
Okay. I mean, they're a lot of them, a lot of single, but they're not trying to buy anything.
I think they're living together, they're renting together. I mean, the things I read are that four or five, six of them are renting a beautiful home, five bedroom home somewhere that they could never afford to live in, except they can now.
Okay.
So I don't hear about many single buyers. Okay. Most of them are family.
Okay.
Young families.
But it's, see, that's, I guess that's just the numbers of that, that generation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of single people that have eliminated themselves from the ability to buy individually because of earnings. And, you know, I think something like 70% of them don't have a full-time job, up to 30. So that's hard to qualify too.
Right.
Well, it seems to me too, you talked about it earlier, you said by the time you were 30, I mean, you were into life big time. I see, it seems to me, I see a lot of people that they're 30, they're living with parents. They haven't even got out of the starting gate yet. And I see a lot of that.
Yeah, there was a, when I was about 22, I'd already been married 5 years, two kids. I called up a friend. I actually had a free Saturday. I couldn't believe it. I called up a buddy of mine. I said, you want to play handball? He said, hang on a second. He said, Mom, do you mind if I go play? And I just laughed because I'm thinking, wow, what a difference 5 years makes. He's asking his mom if he can play handball, and I'm thinking, I've got two kids.
Well, there's a statistic that it's about formation of new households, and you hear it once in a while in the news, and it continues to go down usually. I mean, there's less and less of it. I just don't think people are in a hurry to go out on their own. And
What you see now in your statistics? Are the household formation down?
Household formation down by a lot.
By a lot.
And that's that output gap. You know, that term output gap is really interesting because you have that chunk that was supposed to happen, sort of like, okay, I'm going to retire here because I'm going to make this progression of dollars, and then there's this downturn. So your starting point is 7 years later, but you're down here, and that's sort of household formation did the same
pipeline.
Thing.
It's, the pipeline's got an empty spot in it.
Right. And the problem with that is it's very difficult to play catch-up. You're just starting at the same place 7 years later. The one thing with household formation is you would think 30 years olds want to start a household at some point. I mean, at some point they're going to get married and have a kid. So that could catch up because it seems like numerically they didn't go anywhere. They didn't leave the country.
Right.
They just didn't do what we did at 25. They're going to do it later. So I think that's maybe likely to correct itself. But the other thing you've got is you have a baby boom generation that, and I was going to ask you this, when a baby boomer sells, what do they buy? Where do they go?
Almost always smaller and maybe out of the state.
Okay.
Some out of the state, but certainly smaller. And maybe what we hear most is closer to the grandchildren, wherever that is.
Okay.
Whether it's Oregon or Orange County or whatever.
Okay. That would make sense. The decline in the FHA loan limit, did that have any negative impact?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
2% or
no, that was.
I believe in
the loan limit.
Loan limit. I'm sorry. Yeah, not the cost. The loan limit.
I think that hurt. I do think that hurt.
Okay. What about getting a 3% Fannie Mae product? I've heard that literally very few people have funded one of those loans.
The guidelines are so tight that what's that 2% going to matter? Same as the FHA. There's not a lot of difference between an FHA and a low down conventional loan today.
Right.
Even the condition of the house, you know, like the house has got holes in the wall. We're going to go conventional. 3 or 5% down, they're going to be nitpicking that house just like any FHA or VA appraiser. It's no different. And I see it the same way. It's just, I believe with the lending, you know, they kind of knock the corners off the guidelines, but it still remains very tough.
No substantial difference. Dodd-Frank has been the thing that's hurt our industry, in my opinion, the most in the last 3 years.
And it ramped up until it finally got a day. It said, okay, that's the starting day.
But it created so much fear in every lender.
I think it's still there because I think that they don't want to be repurchasing loans. And I think that is one of the guidelines they're still not sure of. It's when does that kick in? When do I buy a loan back?
Right.
Guys, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.